Welcome to Solutions for the Underaffiliated, the show for people who want hope through examples of improving the overall health of humanity. I'm your host, Eric. And today we have Tyler Malone. He's a research investigator for the North Carolina Rural Health Research Program in the Cecil G. Sheps Center for Health Services Research at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. And this program seeks to address the problems in rural healthcare delivery through research and policy-relevant analysis, geographical and graphical presentation of the data, and the sharing of information to organizations and individuals who can use the information for policy or administrative purposes to address the complex social issues affecting rural populations. And I wanted Tyler to join us today because we've had a lot of guests on the show who allude to the rising costs of healthcare and the disproportionate use of emergency services for Black, Indigenous, and people of color, but we don't talk too much about Americans' rural health. This seems especially relevant since there is so much dissatisfaction in rural communities with the direction of the United States. So, Tyler, thanks a lot for coming in, and why don't you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Yeah, no problem. So that was a great setup, Eric, and wonderful to be here. Really looking forward to our conversation. As you mentioned, I am a research investigator for the North Carolina Rural Health Research Program. We are acutely interested in rural issues, not just in the state of North Carolina, but we also tackle a lot of questions and issues about the national rural population. A lot of the work that we specifically focus on at our center tend to focus on topics related to rural hospitals specifically. It's one of our strengths as a research center. So questions like, what are factors that are related to rural hospital closures? What are the consequences of rural hospital closures? How can you prevent them from happening? But then beyond just topics related to closures, we are, as you mentioned, interested in questions related to social determinants of health and other topics that are generally looking to support the rural health of people in the United States.
Could you explain a little bit about a profile so people understand who are rural Americans? What are you seeing with in terms of demographics? It could be age-related, it could be race-related, but when you think about a rural population, describe who we're talking about.
Yeah, so it's a great way to start off. I have always had the impression that we're talking popular culture and the general media, rural populations are generally painted as a somewhat homogeneous population. And I like to push back on that because no two rural populations are 100% the same. The rural populations that you see, for instance, in the Midwest, like where I grew up, are not necessarily the same demographically as the rural populations you would see in the South or out in the West or up in the Northeast. Now, generally, there are still some demographic qualities. Rural populations tend to be a little bit older than urban populations, generally more likely to be low income, qualify for low income programs such as Medicaid. Those are the two large defining features that I think we normally think of as a research center when we go into a research project, things to keep in the back of our mind. But again, I do want to emphasize there is this diversity to rural populations that I think gets underappreciated sometimes in the wider media.
And by diversity, are you talking about like cultural, ethnic diversity?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And that's one of the things that I think are really important to highlight is, you know, it's like I grew up in Central Illinois, and when people think rural there, they think farmers, they think FFA, they think 4-H. And, you know, that's true for a lot of people. That's true for a lot of people I knew. But agriculture, rurality, it's more than just farmers. There's a wonderful plethora of different types of rural subtypes. And I think as I've traveled throughout the country, and I lived in Illinois, then grew up and went to Michigan for a little bit, and now live here in North Carolina, that's one of the things that I love to see is you go to all these different rural towns and you notice that, you know, no two rural towns are quite the same. And there are differences in culture. There are differences in demographic makeup. And it's those ties that bind. Yes, we're all rural. We do all have some commonalities, but it's the uniqueness of each rural community that is one of the things I love about being a rural health researcher and seeing in my work.
So are you seeing any commonalities among conditions, or, you know, for example, are there similar chronic conditions, even though they're diverse populations? Are there similar behavioral health issues, despite there being different cultures? Are there even different social determinants of health, whether it's food insecurity or transportation? Are you seeing themes that only affect or disproportionately affect rural communities that are related to health?
Yeah, certainly. I think there are social determinants of health that are disproportionately present in rural populations. We were talking just a little bit off the air, and I know several of your previous guests have done really great jobs of highlighting social determinants of health among wider populations. And unfortunately, we see the same exact types of social determinants of health issues within rural populations. Several of the ones that we notice a lot in our research and comes up in some of our studies are things like limited transportation access, things like limited, you had mentioned mental health providers. That's a huge one in rural populations. Unfortunately, again, you see lots of times with rural communities, there's no realistic option. Again, going back to where I grew up, if you had a mental health condition, if you wanted to talk to a therapist and provider, and again, this would have been before the boom in telehealth, you didn't know where to go. There really was no option. I mean, we have several larger towns close to where I grew up, but those would be, you know, 30, 45 minutes away. And that may not sound like that big of a deal for a one-time drive, but if you're having to see a therapist every week, multiple times a week, if you already have other transportation mobility issues, if you don't have a car, that can be huge. That can be the defining barrier behind whether or not you actually go see a mental health provider. And it's a huge challenge. I think even today, even if we move on post-COVID, where telehealth has grown substantially, there still are those transportation-related challenges that a lot of rural communities face.
Okay, I want to get back to the transportation issues, because I think that's a key part of this. But in terms of mental health and behavioral health, are you seeing in these rural communities, can someone argue, be like, well, what kind of mental health and behavioral health issues could there be in rural communities, especially mental health? Because it's just not as hectic as your suburban or your urban environments. Are you seeing more mental health issues in rural populations?
There certainly are some disparities. And you're right. And you know, if we think about sort of the popular conceptualization of an idyllic rural town where the sun is always shining, well, how can there be any issues related to mental health or behavioral health problems? But again, rural folks are just like other people. We all have our own struggles and challenges, and mental health and behavioral health challenges are very much a thing in rural populations, just as they are in urban populations. One of the things that have been highlighted in recent times are the prevalence of suicides among people in rural areas. And I think one of the drivers of that potentially is the isolation of rural communities. Although there certainly are lots of strengths and wonderful things about living in a small rural town, on the flip side, you do have to deal with increased isolation. And again, hearkening back to the COVID days, that was magnified a bunch. You would have these towns that are so tight-knit and built on peer-to-peer interaction, and all of a sudden, you don't have that. Well, if you're living in a small rural town, not only can you maybe no longer see your neighbor for your daily walk, maybe you can no longer go to your local gym or your farmer market, but you don't even really have now maybe as many other options because you're in that small rural town. You don't have other amenities or entertainment options or things to occupy your time. Yes, you do have the advantage of being out in nature and potentially having the opportunity to do more, you know, walks or hikes or just spend time outdoors. But that isolation really can be an important driving factor behind increased suicides. I know, are you familiar with the Rural Health Information Hub? It's a website that does a fantastic job of compiling rural health related research information. I would encourage anyone listening who's interested in rural health to give them a look. They had a video somewhat recently. I forget exactly when the time span was, but that was highlighting the risk of farmer suicide and the challenges of, you know, preventing it going forward. And it goes back to a lot of the factors that I was just mentioning.
Yeah, you bring up a question. Could you describe who is committing suicide? You mentioned farmers. Is it just farmers, or is it a demographic?
This particular video that I had mentioned was focusing on farmers specifically, but no, it does span farther than just the farmer demographic. It is a problem larger than that. That spans across the larger rural population. And it also shows up in urban populations as well. I don't mean to say it's just a rural-only problem, but I think given the unique drivers that are present in rural populations, whether it's potentially lower-income families that are potentially struggling more in times of high inflation or high unemployment, or problems related to isolation that have crept up during COVID, I think they do present unique challenges that are important for behavioral health researchers and the medical community to think about, because solutions that might work for urban populations when it comes to preventing suicide or other mental health and behavioral health challenges might not be as well catered to rural specific populations.
Right. So now we have this picture of the rural population, or at least a little bit, you know, and it sounds like it's a lot of the challenges are just being rural. There's fewer amenities, lower income. Let's talk a little bit about, and you alluded to this, with the landscape of healthcare in these communities. Talked about hospital closings, talked about there not being sufficient mental health providers. Are there PCPs? What does it look like? If I'm living in a small town, what do my options of services look like? Anything from mental health to knee surgery to available hospitals, time and distance. Tell us a little bit about that landscape.
Yeah, certainly. It can vary from rural community to rural community. And they're actually, it's an interesting topic that is very interesting to rural health researchers like myself, in terms of when we talk about rural, there's a spectrum there. And there are actually multiple definitions for defining exactly what does it mean to be rural. And for instance, one of the things that we use when commonly defining the degree of rurality of a particular community is something called a rural urban commuting area code, a RUCA code. And it's scored from 1 to 10, where the higher that is, the more rural that area is. So if you are in a census tract with a RUCA code of 4, you may have better access to care than someone who's in a RUCA code of 10. So someone that's really rural. We have this other definition that is called frontier and remote area codes that, again, describes the degree of rurality and isolation that that community faces. So someone in a FAR code 4 area is going to have a much tougher time in general accessing services than someone in a FAR code of 1 or who doesn't qualify for FAR codes. But let's think of, if we scale back a little bit, let's think about just the typical rural community when it comes to their access. A lot of times when it comes to specialized care, that's where they're going to face the most difficulties. If it comes to accessing, again, mental health providers, other types of specialty care, that's the most likely time when they're going to have to go far distances, maybe 30 minutes, 40 minutes, maybe even up to an hour or more, in order to access that type of care. A substantial portion of rural communities do live within a decent, manageable distance to a hospital. A lot of times these are hospitals that we would classify as critical access hospitals, which is a specific Medicare designation from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And there are specific definitions and criteria that apply to a hospital in order to be designated as a critical access hospital. But the goal of a program like that is to make sure that at the very least, if you're in a rural community, even if you are pretty heavily isolated, you do have access to a hospital that can provide basic emergency services, outpatient services, a lot of times inpatient services. So if you have an emergency or urgent care issue, you can at least go to this local hospital. And then if necessary, you can get transferred to a larger, potentially urban hospital that has higher volume for a specialized type of service.
Okay, so the situation would be that I may have access to what amounts to a critical care facility. However, if I need care beyond that, I should expect to maybe have to get in the car and drive.
In general, and a lot of rural hospitals do a really good job on common surgeries. That's one of the myths that I think does harm to rural communities sometimes is, oh, my rural hospital, my local hospital, it's not going to do a good job on this routine surgery. But a lot of research has shown, a lot of data has shown that rural hospitals do an excellent job on a lot of those simple cases, on a lot of those routine types of care. And it's only when you get to the more specialized type of surgeries that you probably would benefit more from going to a higher volume urban center. But this, we would call it in the research community as the phenomenon as rural hospital bypass. I have a local hospital. They're perfectly capable of providing this service for me. But because of one reason or the other, I decide to skip, I decide to bypass this local hospital in order to go to a further hospital that's farther away. And this has really important impacts on the local hospital. Every patient that passes by is lost revenue, is lost volume. And if you have a substantial degree of bypass, that can really hurt the bottom line of a small local hospital and potentially put it in a higher degree of distress than it, quote unquote, would warrant or deserve, because maybe a lot of these people bypassing would also get really effective care if they just went locally.
Okay. I want to build on that because I'm not familiar with bypass, so I want to talk about it a little bit. Why are people bypassing? And if they're if enough people are bypassing, does it matter if we lose some rural hospitals here and there if people are getting the care they need?
It's a complicated issue because there are times when bypass is recommended. There is a group called the Leapfrog Group that their mission is to help consumers, people like you and I, if we were living in a rural community, decide when are the appropriate times for us to choose a hospital other than our local rural hospital. And again, a lot of these instances have to deal with times that I'm seeking a complicated surgery, something that a rural hospital just isn't likely to have a lot of volume. And volume has a pretty strong correlation in the research literature with surgical outcomes, with post-surgical complications.
How so? Explain that.
So let's say if you're seeking a complicated surgery and your general rural surgeon who's at your local hospital just because of low patient volume for that specific surgery that doesn't crop up a lot in the general population has only performed it several times in a given year at most. Well, just like anything, practice makes perfect. If that surgeon doesn't have as much experience with that surgery, there is a higher risk of post-surgical complications. And in that instance, you would perhaps be better served of going to a large urban hospital or even a larger rural hospital that had surgeons with more experience on that given surgery. So in those cases, bypass would probably be warranted. That would make sense for someone to go to a larger urban hospital with more case volume for that specific surgery. The converse of that, there are plenty of routine surgeries that a rural hospital gets sufficient volume for, and those rural hospitals are perfectly safe and deliver quality outcomes on these surgeries. In those cases, bypass would not necessarily be recommended, and getting care at your local rural hospital, again, is totally fine, can deliver wonderful outcomes for that surgery. And it's one of the things we study is why would someone bypass a given hospital for a larger hospital, even if that local hospital provides the services. One of the things that it can be tough to capture in the data, but I think a lot of people in the research community hypothesize is an important driver, is something like stigma about your local rural hospital. You grow up and you think, oh, that's the, you know, that's the local place. Yeah, it's fine. We know some of the people who work there, but it's probably not as good as the fancy, big, shiny urban hospital down the road. They have a huge cafeteria and they're a 200-bed hospital, and that city's great. And a bunch of factors that really don't have anything to do with the quality of care might impact your decision to go to that urban hospital.
So it seems kind of ironic though, because there is a lot of distrust of urban living, urban dwelling in some rural communities, but yet it sounds like you're saying that, yeah, but there's money there, there's better care, maybe better education, there's going to be better doctors and better facilities.
Yeah, exactly. And it kind of goes back to this notion of, we like to put out the emphasis of shopping locally when it comes to other services, but for whatever reason, when it comes to health, when your health's on the line, you may be more like to say, yeah, but I'd still, if I'm unsure, I'd like to default towards going to that urban hospital. And I get it. I get that notion of, if it's 50-50 or even 51-49, I'm probably going to just defer to going to that larger urban hospital. But again, I want to emphasize, when we've then studied this empirically in the literature, a lot of routine cases, quality of care outcomes are just as good at rural hospitals,
right.
Sometimes even better. And that's not necessarily saying that rural hospitals are superior to urban hospitals, but it just shows they can compete with urban hospitals in certain cases. And people shouldn't just immediately think that just because it's an urban hospital, it's going to do a better job than a rural hospital for a given case. You think of other predictors for bypass. There are demographic indicators. We've mentioned transportation mobility in the past. That's another thing that's a little bit difficult to study with administrative data, just because there's usually not a line item of, do you have a car or do you have access to effective transportation? So it's not something you can put in your model necessarily, but I think there's clearly enough evidence out there that transportation limitations are going to inherently determine whether or not you bypass your local hospital for something further down the road.
What is there a core challenge in rural communities? And before you answer that, one of the things that I read a lot about, I guess, is the concern about hospital closings in rural communities. And there's not enough PCPs or nurses. And we've talked a little bit about mental health. At the same time, it doesn't necessarily sound from this conversation like there's a real urgent need. People can get in the car and go, but they might have to go far. So what is the kind of your take on some of the challenges or the big problems facing rural communities?
Hospital closures is a huge topic.
Okay.
In rural research. It gets a ton of emphasis. It's probably the defining, I think I mentioned it up top, I think it is the defining characteristic of what we study at the North Carolina Rural Health Research Program. It is true that for certain elective conditions, non-urgent care, it may not be a huge deal whether or not you have a local option, because time's not necessarily of the essence. It's not a huge deal if you can go somewhere locally versus somewhere 30 minutes, an hour away. Where it really becomes important is the case of emergency conditions, of urgent conditions. There is evidence, for instance, with sepsis. If you have an emergency sepsis situation and you decide to bypass your hospital then, it can lead to worse outcomes. You are at higher risk of dying if you decide to bypass your local hospital in that emergency situation. Other emergency situations are similar. If we are thinking of an isolated rural community in the mountainous regions out west, if you don't have a critical access hospital, you're going to be in really bad shape if an emergency happens. Because of the travel conditions out there, particularly think during the winter,
right.
If you don't have something local, that's really scary. Not just from when it actually happens, but just from your peace of mind standpoint, knowing living in a rural community like that, if something goes wrong, I don't have a close option, that's going to affect your day-to-day life. That's going to affect your day-to-day psychological well-being. That is one of the huge important reasons for having local options, the very least ones that can provide emergency services in local rural communities. The other big thing I would like to highlight are the economic impacts of local hospitals. Local hospitals are often the biggest employer in small rural communities. They're often a sense of pride for rural communities. When you take out that rural hospital, there is decent evidence that that has negative impacts on the economic well-being of that local community. So not just from a healthcare standpoint, but local hospitals also have a strong benefit from an economic perspective.
So I want to elaborate on that a little bit, because I grew up in a small town, and I know that over the last 20 years or so, a lot of the businesses that were headquartered in these small towns have gone away. So that's one big economic driver and support for the community that's gone. So that's going to decrease the wealth level in that community of folks. The socioeconomic status is going to go down. They've been replaced by hospitals. And what you're saying is that that's another progression. When you don't have the large hospital or health system there, then again, you don't have jobs, which just continues the progression of lower economic and lower less economic opportunity. So why are they closing? Is it just bypass?
There are a lot of contributors, and it can be a very, that's the right way to put it. There's a lot of different reasons. No two closures are exactly the same. One can be from, substantial bypass. There was a shiny new hospital that opened down the road. Ever since it opened, people just haven't been going here locally. It leads to volume reduction. It leads to financial distress. All of a sudden, the hospital can't deal with the lower amount of volume, and they have to close from a financial perspective. Another reason could be like if a hospital CEO has to resign, or if there's fraud, and this isn't a majority of cases, but something like that where everything's going fine and all of a sudden there's a shakeup at the top and we couldn't withstand the managerial change, and all of a sudden we have to close because of that. It's one of the things that we study at the North Carolina Rural Health Research Program. It is financial distress of rural hospitals, with the goal of trying to be able to predict which hospitals are at financial risk over the next several years. And by highlighting those hospitals that are at risk, can we potentially take policy measures to support them to prevent that from happening? I think in general, the largest driver of closures is financial distress. So if we can do more to potentially highlight those that are at the greatest risk, that in our goal is hopefully going to have the best value.
So when you look at risk across the areas you study, how much is there? Should we be alarmed, or is it like, this could take place, or is it going to take place?
With our model, we generally try to position it as a screening tool, as a tool that can say, okay, we've run the numbers, we've crunched the numbers, and based on our findings, this hospital deserves a closer look. We purposely tried to make it more of a conservative model, again, as a first screening tool to say, here are the hospitals that deserve a closer look, that if we can take measures to support them, we probably should. But just because we classify them in those higher risk groups does not mean they're 100% for sure going to close. There's always an opportunity for a community to come up with a creative option to potentially save a rural hospital. So it's, hope is never completely lost with a rural hospital. And there are a substantial portion of rural hospitals that are doing just fine. But one of the goals, again, with this financial distress model that we create, is to highlight those that are maybe doing okay, but could potentially use some help, could potentially use a closer look to see, okay, is everything going as well as it could be? And if not, what are some measures that we could take to support them?
Kind of sticking with the theme of risk, going back to how we started the conversation with the kind of the profile of the degree of quote unquote sickness or relative health in these rural communities, is there a real risk? I mean, I'm just trying to figure out whether or not folks in these rural communities are more sick or healthier, or is there a concern about these hospital closings that puts this particular population more at risk?
I think so. In general, if you're comparing an outcome whatever it is, between a rural population and an urban population. And this is a generality, but in general, those outcomes we often see are worse among rural populations. And that's why if these conditions are worse among rural populations and then their local hospital closes, it can be a bit of a vicious cycle. You already have worse outcomes, your hospital closes, outcomes get worse. Maybe because the hospital closed, economic outcomes also get worse, which lead to worse social determinants of health, which lead to worse health outcomes. It's a cycle, right? And it can become a bit of a spiral in certain situations. And that's one of the reasons we put so much emphasis on hospitals, because they really can be the linchpin and the foundation, the bedrock that supports a rural community.
Do you have an idea of what some of the more common health conditions are, whether they're mental health or physical health of folks in rural communities, just to kind of give a picture of the kinds of things that are ailing folks?
In terms of specifics, I don't know if I'd be able to provide ones to say necessarily here is a great one to highlight, other than we've talked previously about the mental health and behavioral health conditions. One of the reasons I'm clued into that, that's one of my areas of focus going through my PhD program. And even now with my full-time job, it's one of the areas that I really like to study. So it's one of the topics that I'm more clued into. But I do think the general truth holds where regardless of which outcome it is, and there are exceptions, but in general, whichever outcome you're looking at will typically trend towards being worse in rural populations. Now, some of that is not due to any intrinsic reason of being in a rural area inherently makes this outcome worse. A lot of times it can be confounded by other demographic differences between rural and urban populations. Two, we highlighted rural populations are older. Inherently, if you're older, you're going to be at higher risk for a lot of conditions. If you are lower income, which rural populations generally tend to be, you're also going to be at higher risk for a lot of important health conditions.
So again, we've talked about this on other shows. I'm just saying this again from the standpoint of this keep coming up. Health and wealth are linked together, and it's no different in a rural population.
Exactly.
Are there specific policy issues that come to mind that could help address this? And I'm talking about are there policies that are barriers to improving health and improving local hospitals?
Yeah, let's start big. Let's go big picture first. One of the biggest topics on policy researchers' mind at the moment in North Carolina is the topic of Medicaid expansion. So Governor Cooper had signed a bill back in March, I believe, that paved the path forward for Medicaid expansion in the state of North Carolina. Just as a recap, so Medicaid expansion is the low income, is an insurance program designed to provide insurance coverage to low income Americans. Traditionally, if you were a childless adult, you had a really tough time qualifying for Medicaid coverage. Under Medicaid expansion, lots of low income childless adults will now gain coverage. I believe the most recent estimates I've seen is that if Medicaid expansion takes place in the state of North Carolina, as many as 600,000 North Carolinians can gain coverage through that. And I think it's something like as many as 150,000 to 200,000 will gain coverage who also had no other realistic option of getting coverage. That's huge, 600,000 people. Now, with one of the conditions that was required for Medicaid expansion to continue in North Carolina, it was coupled to the passage of a state budget. And one of the initial deadlines they had set for that was we need to have a state budget in place by such and such a date. If that doesn't happen, we have to kick the can down the road in terms of Medicaid expansion implementation. Unfortunately, the state budget wasn't finalized. So now the implementation date for Medicaid expansion is still up in the air. The most recent report I saw was that we are now targeting December 1st of this year, but there's the potential it could go farther than that if certain conditions aren't met along the way, or if we can't decouple the implementation of Medicaid expansion from the passage of a state budget. Medicaid expansion, as I mentioned, would be a huge boon for a large number of North Carolinians in terms of getting insurance coverage. Again, we were talking off air at the start of the show. Medicaid expansion is not a silver bullet. It is a great policy option. It can potentially do a lot of very beneficial things for low-income North Carolinians. However, I would hypothesize that if Medicaid expansion occurs, it's not going to magically transform the health conditions of all North Carolinians who weren't covered, and all of a sudden Medicaid expansion happens, and now everything's great, everything's wonderful. It by itself is not going to solve the disparities between rural and urban populations, even though rural populations do tend to be more low income. But it's an important piece of the puzzle for sure.
Right. Well, they kind of go hand in hand, though. It sounds like what you're saying is look, folks who are in rural areas, a lot of times it hits a socioeconomic problem. They don't have a lot of money, or they're old and things like that. Medicaid expansion would certainly help. It sounds like, unfortunately, there's a little bit of political gridlock.
Yeah.
And there's no other way to describe it. It's that there's folks who are going to say, let's go ahead and do this for these folks, and others who say, that's a lot of money, basically, and do we want to spend our money that way? And so it's not advancing. Meanwhile, folks who tend to be older and lower socioeconomic status are kind of stranded to a degree in these rural communities. So, you know, Tyler, how do we begin to think about addressing some of these problems?
Let's go back to the topic of hospitals specifically. Another big policy option that has occurred recently is this movement towards this introduction of a new hospital payment model called the Rural Emergency Hospital, the REH. We were discussing the risk of hospital closure and its potential negative effects on rural communities, both from a health standpoint and an economic standpoint. We talked about the financial distress model that we do at the Rural Center about, okay, so we've identified these hospitals that are potentially at higher risk, and that can go a long way towards helping hospitals. But what are some other solutions towards helping prevent hospitals from closing while also maintaining services within the local community? That brings us to the Rural Emergency Hospital. The Rural Emergency Hospital is a new model that requires a hospital has to have fewer than 50 beds, has to be located in a rural area, and it says that a hospital going forward has to focus specifically on emergency and outpatient services, and it has to forgo inpatient services from this point forward. Basically, it's this compromise between, okay, we recognize that hospitals are at risk of financial distress and closure. We want to prevent that. There is a fair amount of research that shows that inpatient services are not the financial boon for rural hospitals as they are for urban hospitals. There's multiple reasons for that. We've touched on volume several times in our discussion. Rural hospitals are just less likely to get high volume for a lot of inpatient services. And in a lot of cases, the volume is low enough that it does not overcome the fixed costs of providing those inpatient services. If you can't overcome your fixed cost of inpatient services, it's going to be a financial drain on your hospital, which potentially can increase the risk of it closing. So the REH comes in and says, okay, we recognize that inpatient services are potentially hurting your bottom line as a hospital, potentially contributing to higher risk of closure. Let's just focus on the emergency and outpatient services that, again, as we mentioned in the past, are potentially the really important things that your local facility needs to provide. You keep that as the local hospital, and let's begin essentially outsourcing inpatient care to other facilities farther away. So the rural hospital is theoretically more financially stable because it no longer has to provide costly inpatient services. It maintains the most critical services in terms of emergency care for the local community. The hospital is not going to close, or at least it's less likely to close, because now it can just focus on emergency and outpatient care. And the people in the local community can still get inpatient services, although they now have to drive potentially further away to another hospital farther down the road.
Well, what does that look like? So I'm envisioning someone very sick needs inpatient care. And now I've got to either get in the car, or is there transportation provided somehow to get me from what amounts to, you know, it sounds like, and correct me if I'm wrong, the scenario could be something like I need emergency care and I wind up with some new condition that I've got to have taken care of. And now I've got to be transported to, you know, an inpatient facility that could be an hour away, maybe further. How does that work? That almost seems like it could exacerbate the problem. Do I have time to travel like that?
That's a really, really great question. And that is part of the catch-22 of this new RAH model. Preventing hospital closures is a good thing. Focusing on or allowing your local facility to have emergency services is a good thing. But you can't run away from the fact that under an RAH model, you no longer have those local inpatient services. And for people with transportation challenges, for mobility challenges, potentially for older populations, that can be really critical, is to be able to get to those inpatient services. So as we start to roll out this REH model, we will have to think very carefully in rural communities about how to overcome those other challenges that have been presented upon these rural communities. There's no free lunch, right? The REH model has lots of advantages. That is certainly a disadvantage. People are going to have to find alternative places to get their inpatient care. Now, there are creative solutions to overcome those challenges. One of the things, I know I mentioned the Rural Health Information Hub during a previous segment. One of the videos that I absolutely have loved that I saw recently on there, I have notes on the name, New Growth Transit. There was a video on RHI Hub recently that was highlighting this organization called New Growth Transit. I believe it's based in Missouri. And the core mission of this organization is to form this volunteer network of local drivers. They have a dispatch center, and then their entire driver network is all volunteers locally who then take on the responsibility of driving people with mobility challenges, with transportation challenges, to facilities further away. And based on this video, it's been a very successful program in terms of helping people with transportation challenges.
Where is this?
In terms of the video itself or the program?
The program.
The program, I believe, is Missouri. Yeah, West Central Missouri. And not only does it help people get to needed inpatient care, other care farther away, it also helps address a lot of the potentially social determinants of health that we've talked about previously. The program helps people get to grocery shopping places if they need help there. It gets them to other appointments. So this volunteer driver network is an awesome example of a rural community sourced in-house, essentially, coming together and helping those in need to rise to the challenge that potentially a new policy development that has occurred in that local community. And a lot of times that's what it's going to take is, okay, we have these challenges in a rural community. This policy addresses X, Y. We still have Z to address. Well, now let's complement this first policy with the second policy and maybe a couple other ones. And it's together through this creative thinking that we can create a network, a rural network that supports the health and larger outcomes of the local rural community.
That's a really great example. What is the role, if any, of the private sector? I've read a little bit about large health systems somehow supporting rural hospitals. Is that going on?
I think there's always an opportunity for it, for the philanthropic side of it. Rural communities could certainly benefit from that. There's a big space for private entities to come in and through goodwill, try to help out these challenges that we've been addressing. Certainly, there's big opportunity for that. At the same time, I know this growing up in a rural community, knowing lots of people in rural towns, I think one of the overarching features of rural populations is we pride ourselves on being able to, quote unquote, lift ourselves up by our bootstraps and solve things by ourselves. And there are limits to that. I don't think people should be so quick to always just discount outside help. But that's something like with the transit program I had mentioned, I think so wonderful about it. It is the rural community itself saying, here's a challenge and here's a solution that we came up with to solve this problem. And you see instances of that across the board, particularly in the context of hospital closures. No two closures, again, are exactly the same. The reasons that contribute to a closure in this town is not necessarily going to be the set of the challenges that led to a closure in this other town. There are lots of examples over the years of communities coming together to save their local rural hospital. Now, often that takes creative thinking. It sometimes requires a single champion or a group of champions that say, I have this idea. I believe this is a way forward for us to protect this rural hospital, and the courage and determination and resources to implement those approaches to save their local facility. And again, there are lots of examples like this in rural communities of them coming together and going to that adage of lifting yourself up by your bootstraps and truly coming up with a solution to save their local healthcare options.
So we've talked about a really vibrant volunteering network, whether it's for transportation or for saving a hospital. We've talked about the rural emergency hospital, which is really a concentration of care to emergency services from a hospital, and then the transport of folks to a larger hospital or a hospital that has more services. You know, that potentially means someone's going to have to travel. We've talked a little bit about the private sector potentially getting involved. What, if any, is the role of policymakers in supporting rural health?
I think it goes back to the idea of setting the foundation for a rural community so that these other more specialized programs can take the baton and carry it past the finish line. Something like Medicaid expansion, again, can be great for setting that foundation, at the very minimum, making sure that everyone has access to some form of health insurance. Again, that's not a silver bullet, but it's a great first step. So policymakers being able to find solutions to help individuals access health insurance from a financial perspective is huge. I think it's a great first step. The REH model that we mentioned is a policy-driven solution. Coming up with creative solutions like that, coming up with flexible opportunities, flexible solutions for hospitals to say, this default method probably doesn't work best for us, but this alternative might. So just giving hospitals more options that they can then cater to their specific rural community, I think is a huge win. And that is something, as if I was talking to a policymaker, if I was talking to the NC General Assembly, it's one of the things I would highlight is policies like this that give rural communities more flexibility can be really valuable.
Okay. What are a handful of things you really want people to think about?
I think the most heartwarming part for me, again, is going back to some of these other policies. So if I can speak to the rural communities themselves for a second, I would say there are ways forward from a creative standpoint. Again, whether it's the transit program we mentioned, I know listening to some of your previous shows about mental health GPS, I think was one of the things you had highlighted in a previous show. I thought that program was fantastic. I think creative solutions like that, that can truly use the rural community itself, the rural community network, can be really, really important and valuable to those communities. So I would encourage that sort of creative thinking. Again, big top-down policies like Medicaid expansion, even something like an REH model, can be really important, but I would not discount the power of rural communities finding creative solutions to the health problems of today.
Tyler, thank you very much for coming in today. So join us next week for another illuminating episode of Solutions for the Underaffiliated. We're going to be talking with Jonathan Hunt Glassman, CEO and co-founder of OAR Health, and Dr. Joshua Lee, who is OAR's chief clinical advisor and is an associate professor in the Department of Population Health and Medicine at NYU Grossman School of Medicine in New York. And we're going to be talking about substance abuse disorder with them, and about ways of taking that on. Till then, remember to check out all of our podcasts of this show at underaffiliated.com. Have a great day, everybody.